Hey everyone, John here. Just a quick word of warning. We will be spoiling this film in its entirety. So if you have not seen this film and you don't want it spoiled for you, just hit pause real quick and go and watch the movie and then come back and enjoy the show.
This is what's gonna happen. Christmas Eve, we're gonna go our separate ways because I think that's a lot easier than calling our family and trying to explain why we have to be bailed out of jail.
Family.
Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of Surviving Chick Flicks. I'm John.
I'm Sammy.
And I'm Joseph.
And I thought it was Pride Month, but I guess this week it's Christmas. What's going on here? Like, had I known, I could have saved this for December.
You did your absolute best to try and ruin my favorite holiday, but at least you didn't do it during December. So, you know, there's that.
Well, he's being considerate.
I'm just sitting here going, I will get you next time, McDaniel. Anyway, so this week we are wrapping up Pride Month. This week we are talking about the 2015 Tangerine, starring that guy from Sinister and the dad from Nightmare on Elm Street 2. The only people in this movie I knew. And this is a rare one because this is a movie that, even though we'll get into it, we'll do the usual question, but none of us had seen movie go to it, so I'm kind of looking forward to what Joseph liked and how I ruined Sammy's day. So why don't we play the trailer and we'll find out.
Hey, Alexandra, come here. Listen, have you seen Cindy?
Cinderella. Looks like someone has a crush.
Cindy's back on the block?
Oh yeah, she's back. She's back and she's going hard.
Merry Christmas, bitch.
I got some good news to tell you
about me and Chester.
I know what it is. You're breaking up with him.
Thank God.
I'm gonna be cheating on you like that.
Wait. What?
You didn't know?
White boy.
Who is she? Her name starts with a D.
Danny.
Desiree.
Destiny?
You're making me lose my game.
She's some white fish.
Chester, did she know me with real fish?
Yeah, bitch, like a real fish. Girl, like vagina and everything.
Girl, calm the fuck down. It's not that serious.
I would go with you under one condition. You must promise me that there's not going to be any drama.
I promise.
Look at me in my eyes and promise.
I promise no drama, Alexandria.
Whoa! What the fuck?
Oh, boy.
Help me, officer!
You didn't have to Chris Brown the bitch.
What did you do to her?
Does your friend ever shut up?
No. That bitch been talking ever since I met her.
Why does he owe you money?
We made a business transaction.
You're not even hard yet.
Fucking hard. That's hard.
Chester.
Sense him. Who's your man? Who's hot piece for you?
Cindy, what do you see in him? Talk to me.
They've been out of jail for 24 hours. She started causing drama.
She called the police.
The cops are coming. Come on, girl.
Out here, it is all about our hustle. And that's it.
This motherfucking girl thing.
All right, Tangerine, starring Kitana Kiki Rodriguez, Maya Taylor, James Rand, Mickey O'Hagan, Karen Karagulian, and an appearance by Clue Gulager, directed by Sean Baker. So, variation of our usual question. What day in the last week and a half did y'all watch this movie? Because this is a first-timer for us. So, you know, these were... We all did it within in between the cheerleading movie, which was fun, and this one, which is not.
So approximately 23 and a half hours ago.
All right. Damn, we almost made you wait a whole day.
Mine was just like a few hours ago.
Oh, oh my gosh, you actually beat me.
Yeah.
He was just like, well, she does it all the time. Why can't I?
Exactly. It's my turn.
We're really on top of our game over here, John. We do not procrastinate, no matter what you say.
So I managed to watch it about a week ago. So look, the overachiever here.
Show off.
All right. So this film came out in 2015. And the thing that they kind of sold this movie on was not so much about how it was a gritty day-to-day examination of the life of transgender sex workers, but instead they all kind of came in their shorts so that this movie was shot on an iPhone. Like, they sold it as the movie they made on an iPhone. That was all I knew about it, other than that it was a movie about two trans women and that they let a cis guy make it. And it wasn't a train wreck.
Yeah, that's all I remember about this movie. It's like, it was shot on iPhone. And I was like, that's all I remember about the movie. I knew it was about somebody that was trans, but that's as far as I knew.
Yeah.
You know, we've done, what is it, 2 years of this now?
Mm-hmm.
And I now begs the question, is there such thing as an uplifting or upbeat trans movie? Because if there is, I dare you to find it, because so far you have not.
Well, here's the thing. The answer is probably, but the sub-question to that is, does the trans community hate it? Because there is the possibility that there is a trans movie out there that doesn't deeply offend the trans community. Like, everyone was played by, you know, actual trans actors or dare we say actual trans filmmakers. So most of what we're going to have is a whole bunch of cis people speaking for a class of people that is not them.
Well, let me ask you that though. I guess we can kind of get into this. Is it so much who plays the characters as the subject matter of the film? Because this doesn't necessarily portray trans people in the best light. It doesn't portray them in a negative light necessarily, but it portrays all of them in a very terrible situation.
Okay, so to answer the first part of that question, in 2022, yes, it does matter who's playing them. In fact, Tom Hanks, as he's promoting that movie you're going to make me watch, people have brought up the fact that he got his Oscar for playing a gay man with AIDS, you know, and would he do that again? And he goes, well, now, no, we wouldn't do that. And it's great that we, you know, it shouldn't fall. I am badly paraphrasing what Tom Hanks said, but he was basically like saying straight people should not be telling gay stories because we have gay actors to tell that, you know. It's nice that he has said that. So while something like that Felicity Huffman movie, Trans America, that came out back in like 03 or 04, was like groundbreaking, revolutionary, even something like Boys Don't Cry in the late 90s, what was once daring, edgy, and great that someone was telling these stories, at the end of the day, they were still falling in the hands of the cis community, whereas we have people like Laverne Cox and the ladies in this movie that could tell those stories just as well, because it's all about the representation.
I understand that, and I don't have any argument with that. I think the point I was making with that is, not that these are not important stories to tell. I'm not saying that they're not. The same way that we discussed last week, that Milk was an important story to tell, that, you know, those are important stories to tell. My point is, it falls into the same pattern as a lot of the early LGBTQ movies, which their entire focus was on the fact that they're a member of that community and what they were going through. It's a devastating and tragic story. It's not necessarily uplifting, which was what was so great about but I'm a cheerleader is because it was like, it was just, I mean, don't get me wrong. It had a subtext, but it was kind of, at least the vehicle they used to tell the story was a comedy, you know, and like a cheesy, campy movie. And that's all I'm saying is like, it would be nice. Yeah. It'd be nice to get to that place where that's a thing.
Well, my only counter to that is right now, I mean, everyone in the LGBTQ community, shit, words are hard, you know, is not, there is still so much opposition to the LGBTQ community as it is. And of all of them right now, the trans community is having the hardest time. So there's not necessarily always a lot of uplifting stories to tell. Everything that is going to be told now, and I please need someone from the trans community to correct me on this, if anything I'm saying is wrong, you know, it's going to be something like telling the story of Marsha P. Washington, or wow, Marsha P. Johnson, who was one of the trans women who started the Stonewall Riot. And her life did not end in did not end well, or a story like this, because a lot of transgender women do end up in sex work. One of the actresses in this movie is a former sex worker, so the hill to die on for this movie is whatever you think of it, good, bad, or you know, whether it's uplifting or not. This film is at least honest in telling the story as it is. The previous, you know, the past stories of the LGBT representation in movies went from they don't exist except for this glaring stereotype that we're just going to kind of, you know, make a joke about, or they're the villain in the movie, like, or if the lesbian must die tragically and heartbroken and not having true love. And thankfully, we have moved out of that. But for right now, I mean, I don't see a lot of uplifting trans stories because, well, all we have to do is look at the news. I mean, I would love to see, I would love to see like the transgender heist movie. I would love to see Heat with trans women, or, you know, the comic version of that.
Well, but, I mean, I don't know, and I guess maybe my exposure to it was a little bit different, because the first time I noticeably saw a trans actress in anything was in Orange is the New Black. And, you know, and she was in an all-female prison, and it was part of the story. It was not like they didn't, it's not like they just like, oh, we're just going to pretend this isn't a thing and try and work around it. No, they made it apparent, but it was just part of a larger story, and she was treated normally. Not that she didn't get some... I don't know. I guess just the way they handled it was very... I thought was very, very good.
Well, and I get your point. And also, we have better representation now, and that's the great thing, because we have Laverne Cox, not just in Orange is the New Black, but she's been in so many other roles as well. And I mean, because she was in Promising Young Woman, and she's getting roles outside of that Orange is the New Black. We also have Jamie Clayton, who is set to be the new Pinhead in the upcoming Hellraiser reboot. But, you know, she went from Sense8, which was the Netflix show, the Wachowskis, or however the hell we say their names, I forgot already. But they were in that show that Lana and Lily created for Netflix. And then Jamie's a main character on the L Word reboot on Showtime, for better or worse there, because God knows the biggest villains for the L Word is the writer's room. Who killed Jenny? It was fucking Eileen Chaykin, that's who. I said it. So. But, well, and, go ahead.
You know, trans movies are just now getting to where it's you can actually put it out and actually people will go see it. Because back in the 90s and even early 2000s, nobody would have gone and seen it, really.
Yeah. And also,
not trying to say, you know, rightfully so or anything. It's just one of those, like, it just wasn't going to be viable back then.
Yeah. Yeah, it was easier to tell a gay story or a lesbian story.
Even that was one of the kind of tricky at times.
Well, what I'm saying is, you know, we started having, you know, when we were actually able to tell queer stories, we got things, you know, in the late 60s, like, or early 70s, like Boys in the Band, which had gay actors playing gay characters and no one fucking died at the end of the movie. Spoiler alert. And then we were more comfortable telling lesbian stories. We're just now getting around to getting bi representation in media. And, you know, now we're getting to tell trans stories that, you know, where they aren't making a fucking people suit, even though I know the movie did try to say that Buffalo Bill was not transgender in Silence of the Lambs, but it's, you know.
Yeah.
Hey, not even an A for effort.
By the way, when we get to my plug, one of the main characters in the show I'm plugging is bi. And is a guy. And I thought that was a very interesting and kind of unique choice she made.
Yeah.
And everybody loves that character too.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we're slowly starting to get pansexual characters in media. And, you know, maybe one day we'll get the asexual representation and, you know, the rest of the alphabet. And, you know, we have very few intersex stories.
I feel like you can kind of see the way it's going to go, because I do feel like Black media was sort of the precursor, and you can see the route it takes, because for a very long time, not always, but for a very long time, a lot of what you saw in Black filmmaking was stories about... They were devastating. They were true stories that 100% needed to be told. And some incredible filmmaking came out of that. But it took a long time to get to the point where Black representation became more like, you know, they were in every kind of media, as opposed to we're going to make stories about, you know, the tragedy that we endured, which... Like I said, incredibly important stories, but it took a long time to get to the point where they were making other kinds of films were able to be made, and there was far, far better representation, as there should have been.
Yes, but also it is a film business, and the movies that were making money for the African American community for the longest time was the Blaxploitation movement, which there are some great movies in there, and then there's Blackula. So even though I kind of don't hate Blackula, but there was the double-edged sword of the Blaxploitation movement, where it's just like, fuck, we got representation, you know, by any means necessary. But it's also like, do we have to play a fucking pimp or a drug dealer or a criminal in every one of these movies? And so, you know, for every Shaft, there's, you know, Superfly or the Mac, even though I do like Superfly. And so, and also there was a big boom in the 90s where Black filmmakers were getting to tell Black stories, but it was also telling stories like Boys in the Hood or Menace to Society or Juice, where they were telling kind of the similar story like this film, even though this movie was made by a cisgender male. It was just like, yeah, we you can have an uplifting story about us all you want, but also this is the shit a lot of us deal with day in, day out. And so that's why, unfortunately, the only possibly uplifting trans film I can name, I can't even say the title of, because as the T slur, but it was a... in the title, but it was kind of a transgender kind of horror comedy called Ticked Off T-Slurs with Knives.
Okay.
Yeah, which not coming to surviving chick flicks anytime soon. just going to put that out there. So, and there's also stories like, you have movies like The Danish Girl, which was made fairly recently, where the star of that movie, Eddie Redmayne, who played a trans woman, has come out and said, yeah, I probably shouldn't have played that role. And then you have stories like Boy Meets Girl, which I know Joseph and I have seen that, which is a romantic comedy between a cis man and a trans woman.
Yeah.
But I know that many people in the transgender community do have a problem with that movie because it's just like, oh, it's all about the cis guys giving, telling this trans woman that it's okay and that he loves her because it ends up being about him. So we're getting there. We will just have.
Let me ask, do people have an issue with Brokeback Mountain given that it was, you know, the main characters are played by straight actors?
I think if you made that movie now, instead of having two straight men in the lead roles, they would want queer actors. There is still a reverence for film. There's a documentary on Netflix called Disclosure, and they touch on Silence of the Lambs, and how, you know, here's this movie that is loved by so many, but the villain is allegedly transgender, and the movie does a piss poor job of trying to say Buffalo Bill isn't really transgender. But so many in the trans community have a problem with that representation, and I get it. I am not going to argue with them on that, even though I love Silence of the Lambs, and I get what the movie was trying to do, and I get to, and I see what the trans community sees, and I feel I've skirted away from the from the question, but. There's still that love for that movie. There's still a love for Boys Don't Cry because someone was telling that story and they did it with reverence. So,
Milk, the too. Different, I mean, think about it.
Yeah, Milk, Brokeback Mountain. Those films still get a pass because they were at least telling honest stories that were, you know, told with reverence for the community. if they were to be made now, they're... It is so much easier just to get a gay actor to play a gay character, even though you do have actresses like Kristen Stewart who hate that we have to have this discussion now because by the same logic, it does keep her from playing straight roles if she chooses to. And I know there's argument to be made about it's acting, it should be the best person for that part. But at the same time, we stopped doing blackface and yellowface and redface for those communities. And we're starting to get better about Jewface, even though things like, well, I mean, Shiva Baby had a non-Jewish actress playing a Jewish character. And the lead of the Marvelous Miss Maisel is not Jewish. As long as, and I'm one of those people that yes, you, whoever is playing that character should, you know, be representing their community. But at the same time, if they're not, they at least need to be doing it with reverence. Because,
right,
from what I understand, Marvelous Miss Maisel is a pretty good show. So no one's saying that Brokeback Mountain is terrible because two straight men played the leads. What I'm just saying is that in 2022, if they were making Brokeback Mountain now, they would be looking at, like, Zachary Quinto and Matt Bomer. And now that I say that, I kind of want that movie.
That I feel like that would bring a whole new career for Natasha Lyonne because, like, I mean, she's sort of been typecast in that role, and she's not.
Yeah. But at the same time, Natasha Lyonne is not going to, you know, walk around with a short haircut and a baseball jersey shouting the D slur just because her character is a lesbian. She's going to treat it with respect.
Correct.
Yeah. And you now have people like Tom Hanks seeing, like, 1993 or whenever he did Philadelphia, which was apparently an apology for Silence of the Lambs on Jonathan Demme's part. He would be like, no, it would be stupid for me to play as a straight man to play a gay character that's, you know, a gay character should play that character now. And I'm glad we have that, you know, and so that way, and he was happy that if they were wanting to make Philadelphia now, they have this plethora of gay actors that could take the role.
Well, they, you know, I mean, I will give this film props. Like, I mean, they were able to find good representation. Now, does that necessarily a good movie make?
That is a completely different argument.
I will say, I do think the iPhone ended up being less of an issue than I thought it would be. Like, the actual filming of the movie was fairly interesting, and it was very documentary style, which kind of worked. But the story is what I found, like, a disconnect from.
Yeah. Well, and that is 100% fair. I think I kind of knew what I was getting into because I have seen another Sean Baker film. Let's talk about Sean a little bit. He's a filmmaker. He first got his start, honestly, doing a sitcom for Fox called Greg the Bunny, which was a sitcom in which the human world and the puppet world collided. And there are actually shades of what Sean Baker would go on to do in that show, because it did focus a lot on racism towards the puppet community. But then it also had times where Warren the Ape was trying to do Shakespeare with Gary Oldman.
Wait, I'm sorry. Hold on a second. Did you say racism towards the puppet community?
Yes.
I feel like you're going to need to clarify.
It's a show where humans and puppets exist. Greg the Bunny, the titular character, is the roommate of Seth Green.
Okay, and people are racist against puppets?
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
It's the same way with, because, kind of like when the X came about, it was a response to the civil rights movement that was going on and their backlash from it. They used mutants as a way of saying, hey, people hate mutants just because they exist.
Yeah, so it's all about the other.
Yeah, it was an allegory for racism and just bigotry in general.
There was also a character in that show called Tardy the Turtle that had the immortal line of "the green ones make me horny" in reference to M&Ms. So it didn't handle a lot with a very genteel manner. It was also like the late 90s, early 2000s when that show existed. So,
yeah, but like, I like the look of this film because I thought the filming on an iPhone gave it that documentary feel, because you pretty much are just following the lives of these people that just, what is it, in just one day?
Yeah, well, this film takes place in one day, but this has kind of become what Sean Baker's focus is now. He went from, he got his taste of studio money, even though it was a puppet movie, a television show at Fox. He probably had more money working on that show than he has on any of his on his subsequent films. But he is tending to focus on, if there is a nicer way of saying lowlife, I would love to have used that word instead, because a lot of his films are on marginalized groups. Basically, his three biggest films are this film, The Florida Project, and last year's Red Rocket. Tangerine focused on transgender sex workers. The Florida Project told a story of a prostitute living in a motel run by Willem Dafoe, who is just trying to keep his shit together. And Red Rocket is about a porn star that went home.
Yeah.
So...
starting to see a theme.
Yeah, but he loves, but these are more, he's telling interesting stories, inexpensively, instead of trying to, go back to a studio system that's going to force him to do something he doesn't want to. Like, we're not going to see the Sean Baker MCU movie, at least not for a while.
No, especially if he makes movies like this where they have very interesting subject matter. And because Tangerine's not trying to be preachy at all, from what I've just, it just follows these people's lives they go through.
I mean, initially, I have to say, it really confused me. I was not sure what he was trying to do, because I understood at the beginning, but the back and forth between the taxi driver and the two women was like, it did not connect. until...
Well, I mean, it kind of did, because as we see the cab driver, Razmik, who is an immigrant from Armenia, raising his family, driving a cab, he's got a thing for prostitutes, and he has a thing for a certain kind of prostitute. And I don't know whether or not he's a chaser or not, because I know he has a thing for Cindy in this movie, but at the same time, like, is he planning on leaving his wife for Cindy, or does he just want to give Cindy a blowjob every now and then?
You know what? I thought this was actually going to be a much, much, much darker film, because when he first, like, when he picked up the first prostitute, I thought that was going to go a whole different way, and I thought this was actually about him being, a serial rapist or serial murder of trans women, and I was like, oh my god, this is gonna get so much darker. But it ended up actually not being like that at all, and he was kind of a very endearing character, so
yeah.
I will say that was an upside. I saw that going.
If it was 1983 and this was directed by Brian De Palma, that's 100% the movie you were gonna get, or the transgender woman was going to be the murderer. Call back to Dress to Kill. But I think had this movie gone the darker route, ending with either a transgender prostitute murderer or murdered, this film would not have gotten a fraction of the praise it got, and it would have been another example of, oh, here's just another cis filmmaker telling a trans story and, you know, and getting money from our pain and misery. Like,
yeah, it would have
that would have been the easy route, and it would have been the cop out.
It would have been.
Yeah.
I think they
and
I
then
think,
we wouldn't have gotten stuff like Florida Project.
Yeah, and I think he told a really good story. I think they all did a really good job of just kind of acting like it was just a normal day. Just one of those that just and nothing like there's no twists and turns in it. It's a very straightforward movie.
Yeah. But Joseph, it's not a normal day. It's Christmas Eve, bitch.
That's true. Okay, a normal Christmas Eve on the streets.
That was the most traumatizing scene in the entire film.
Wait, what was the most traumatizing scene in the film?
The guys in the cab.
That went on a little too
long. Oh, the one that puked?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't know the meaning of the word. You don't know the meaning of the word brief, John. I think you need to look it up.
Hey, I at least warned you.
You did.
Apparently, yeah. And all I said was just don't eat when it's happening, because that ruined the last bit of my meal.
Yeah, I don't watch when it's happening would have been a better warning.
I thought that was clear. That was the subtext of what I was going for.
Yeah, well, you should have been more like the writers of Nightmare on Elm Street 2 and just gone with text.
So our main characters in this movie are Cindy Rella and Alexandra. Both of them are transgender sex workers. Both of them played by actual trans women. And Cindy, S-I-N... -DEE, because we love puns, had just got it out of jail.
28 days, to be exact.
Yeah, 28 days, and back on the streets. And the main focus of... It's like all three of our main characters, because I would lump Razmik, the cab driver, in as the third main character of this, because we spend as much time with him as we do the other characters. You have two prostitutes and a cab driver. One of them just found out her pimp fiance boyfriend is cheating on her. The other one just desperately wants to get through the day so she can perform her show. And the other one is providing for his family while spending all the money he makes by literally blowing prostitutes.
True.
Merry Christmas, guys. We're going to sandwich this one in between Home Alone and Die Hard this holiday.
You know, I mean, I feel like I've warned you. I warned you, and I just think that you want to watch all the High School Musical films and Mistletoes.
In my defense, when I put this on the list, I did not exactly know where this movie was going.
He's got a point.
Yeah, still not good enough. If I have to suffer, so must you.
Yeah, but Joseph has to watch them too. So it's punishment for me and amusement for me as well, because he's
getting punishment. And you say that, but you've survived all but one of them, I think.
Yeah, I did, because one of them had a dead woman in it.
Eventually you're going to get over that. But
I'll get over it when you stop making sleepaway camp jokes.
I make no promises.
I don't think there's going to be a promise on that one.
Yeah. So, one of the actresses in this movie, Maya Taylor, whenever she was cast in this movie, whenever filming began, she had just started taking hormone replacement therapy. And,
wow, I mean, that's interesting. Is that something is that something they talked about in commentary?
Unfortunately, I had to watch the streaming, so I didn't get a commentary, but it was in the in the trivia for the film. Also, our two leads were actually friends in real life, so, and I know Maya was a former sex worker, so it would stand to reason that they probably both were, which, you know, sad to admit, but at least that helped lend an air of further authenticity to this story.
Yeah, it does. And it's one of those, they did a, I don't know what I'm going to try to say here. But it does, it is unfortunate to say that, but it's one of the, it does lend authenticity to it.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, probably the most realistic moment in this entire film also might have been my favorite scene, is the scene with the middle-aged white guy that was from the suburbs that abandoned his family on Christmas Eve and only brought $40.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what he thought he was going to get for $40.
I think he thought he was going to be able to haggle his way into a blowjob.
Yeah.
And instead, he just didn't go to jail that day.
Yeah, he ran into the nicest, most reasonable officer ever.
Yeah, who was probably...
I don't know if it was, like, nice or anything. It was just more of like, I don't want to deal with this. Can we just say it never happened?
Yeah. It's just like, either you two just walk away from this, or you're both going to jail. Or I have to do jail.
A shit ton of paperwork, so walk away.
But, I mean, it probably didn't come off as nice, but on the most basic level of nice, it is, because it's just like, I really don't want to have to, you know, fuck up your family's Christmas, but also I don't want to have to bust this woman again for, you know, trying to earn so she can eat. It's just like, it's just easier, like, y'all walk away, you know, like, she did him a favor. So, was anyone else surprised that this movie was rated R and not NC-17? As we've learned how shitty the MPAA is.
No, not really, because it wasn't actually that, like, gratuitous, at least, like...
Compared to shit I've made you watch. It wasn't
that sexually explicit. Everything was covered up. Everything was kind of tastefully done. I thought the car wash was a very interesting choice. But I'm not really surprised. Yeah. And I mean, you know, the weird thing about it was like, at its core, this movie is very simple. It's entirely about a trans woman trying to track down her cheating boyfriend and a cab driver. Like,
yeah,
that's it.
And honestly, I could have watched an entire movie of her just like angrily walking through the streets of Los Angeles with the iPhone zooming behind her. Like,
oh, is that where they were? I could not figure out where they were.
Yeah, they were in one of the seedier parts of Los Angeles. But this was actually Sean Baker's first R-rated film, because most of his films didn't even have, all went like unrated. And I think this may be the first time he had enough money to actually pay for the MPAA to screen his film. So...
Oh, wow. I really did like the whole sequence where she actually goes into the house, which is pretty much like a little, like a kind of small rundown brothel.
Oh, the hotel room?
Yes.
I was just sitting here making the Sean Baker extended cinematic universe and was just like, oh, is this the same hotel from the Florida Project?
But yeah, I did like it, even though it was violent, but it was one of those that wasn't, you never felt like any of them were going to be like murdered or anything like that, but it's just, she dragged her ass all the way through town.
Yeah. I was going to say, the only person there was in danger was Dinah, and really all she, at worst, was just going to beat her ass.
Yeah. She had a couple bruises on her and everything. But it was kind of one of those, like, I can't believe that this is how it's going down, but at the same time, I was like, this is kind of a interesting way of doing it, because they kind of intercut it with other things that's going on in the movie.
Yeah, and I believe one of the Johns in the hotel room was just like, call the cops, and the lady who was, I guess, Chester's madam was just like, yeah, let's get the cops in here.
Get the whole fucking precinct while we're at it.
Yeah, that was one of the best ones.
That's one.
Oh, and we forgot the other, like, most important part of this storyline, which was that everyone needed to come see her show that night.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, Razmik had trying to find Cindy on his mind. That was his story. Cindy was looking for Dinah and Chester. And Alexandria needed something to do. And I can see that being important, because it's probably something she had talked about wanting to do for a long time. And also, does that not represent the reality of, you know, trying to do some kind of show, like, the only, like, everyone says they're going to come, and then it's like two people, and one of them is the prostitute your friend dragged.
When you finally talk Chester up through the whole movie, you think he's just going to be this big badass, and he is one of the worst people in the world, barely even passable as a pimp.
Played by James Ransone, who was Deputy So-and-So in the Sinister films.
I forgot about that, but yeah, he did a good job playing the character. At the same time, it was just like, they played him up so much, and I was like, this is what you're mad about? This guy?
Well, it's probably a very accurate representation of pimps, at least in this era.
True.
Yeah, you know, it's not, you know, someone out of Superfly, it's some idiot in a tracksuit.
Yeah, I just expected him to be kind of, I don't know, like, the way they were talking about him, like, scarier. And this one, really?
I never got that he was going to be scary, considering the entire crux of Cindy's story was she was going to go yell at him for sleeping with someone else and drug her down with him.
Well, I don't mean like they were scared of him. It was more of like that just he didn't take shit. And I didn't expect him to be until then, like he was a huge dumbass, really.
Oh no, that's what I meant. I think we were kind of saying the same thing. Like, I never got him like to be a badass character. I assumed whenever, you know, someone had enough chutzpah to go drag the girl he was cheating with to him to yell at him in public, she wasn't that damn afraid of him.
Well, no, but I thought that was just her character, too, that she was just one of those that was going to do whatever she needed to do. It didn't matter.
Yeah. I think it's a column A, column B kind of situation.
Yeah, probably true. But yeah, that last bit in the whole the donut shop was pretty good.
Yeah. I love the big explosive conclusion where Cindy is confronting Chester, drops the bomb on her that he slept with her in-law, family Christmas, find her son-in-law, and calls his wife to tell him that he's sleeping around with prostitutes. And I love the wife's reaction of, Mom, just mind your own business. And it all comes to a head whenever the poor donut shop owner is like, if you don't leave, I am calling the cops on all of you.
Yeah, that poor donut shop owner, but mother-in-law definitely did not mind her own business.
She did not.
No, she didn't.
She cared way more than her daughter did.
I think her daughter cared, but at the same time, he was doing everything he could to, you know, with what money he didn't spend on prostitutes, you know, provide for the family.
So here's a question. Do you think she knew?
Probably, or at least had a suspicion. You know, he didn't take the best route out of Armenia, which is start a great progressive rock metal band. So see, Sammy, there's this band called System of a Down. They're all from Armenia. They're all from Armenia.
That I did not know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the only reason that the drummer and the rest of the band are able to come together, because they are wildly different politically, is because they recently did a charity single to raise awareness about the Armenian genocide. So.
Oh, wow. Very cool.
Plus, they're just a great band.
They are.
Even though I am a wildly different politically from their drummer, he can play. I have to give it to him. He can play. Plus, they're like brother-in-laws, him and Serge.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Probably the reason that they haven't found another drummer.
It probably is.
Yeah. So, did anyone else see Chester and Alexandria sleeping together coming?
I didn't.
No, I did not. I was completely taken aback.
Yeah, that's one of those. I was like, really? Is he just talking shit, or is this actually, did it really happen? But then it gets confirmed, like, oh yeah, it happened.
Yeah. It's like, that's the biggest thing. It's like, that's the biggest reveal in the entire movie, is that Alexandria also slept with him while Cindy was in jail. Yeah. But Dinah also did have a point, as shitty as it was. It's like, because as Dinah says, I've never had a pimp that didn't fuck me. And it's like, how can she be that surprised? Because if you look up...
No, go ahead.
Go ahead. I was going to say, because if you look up moral upstanding citizen in the dictionary, you do not see a picture of Chester.
That's very true.
Yeah.
What? You mean the pimp? He's not the picture child for citizen of the year?
I know this is hard for you to believe, Sammy, but...
Yeah, I just don't believe it.
And for me, I think the most harrowing scene...
Good... upstanding citizen with a lot of good moral character. I think he had a very philanthropic nature about him.
So the most harrowing scene for me, honestly, yes, just moving right along, has to be the very end, whenever the guys in the car throw urine on Cindy. And it does allow the two main characters to reconnect in the laundromat. Like, for all the shit that happens, you know, they're able to, you know, come together at the end and remain friends.
And they'd really been separated the whole movie.
Well, Cindy had a prostitute to go drag around Los Angeles, and Alexandria had a show to promote, so.
And did not
want to. They had shit to do that. Yeah.
Yeah, they all. They all had sure they get everything done.
She woke up that day and she's like, I got a to-do list. Wake up, buy Cindy a donut, make some money, promote the show, do the show, go home. She got to check off all of her things. So
is there anything y'all want to discuss before we move into our segments?
I think I've got a couple things, but they fit nicely into segments. So.
All right. Well, I don't know if all of our segments will apply to this week's movie, but I do think I noticed this. So I do think our first one definitely does, which is, did John like the soundtrack?
So while I didn't have a traditional soundtrack or anything that I could really find on Spotify, I did love the music in this film, what little there is. Whenever Cindy is a woman on a mission, I love that kind of the kind of techno score that was going along with it kind of reminded me, and Joseph, you will be the only one in this conversation that gets this, but it did remind me a little bit of Run Lola Run.
Oh yeah. I really like the soundtrack to this. That's one of the things I really love this movie.
Yeah, and I like the Alexandria song that she performed in the bar. Like I think what little music is in this movie works. So yeah, it gets a thumbs up from me, dog.
Yeah, that one of the few times I was like, oh yeah, I've noticed a lot of the music. It's like I really like this.
Mm-hmm.
It fits well.
Yeah. And I think because the music reminded me of Run, Lola, Run, that's why I wanted the whole movie just to be just about Cindy going to find Dinah and Chester. Run, Cindy, run.
Yeah. I thought the music was, like, it fit really well. It was really tailored to each moment, but it was kind of anxiety-inducing. Like, it was very adrenaline-pumping.
Yeah.
So, I don't think there's not a Roger Ebert didn't do a
Roger Ebert was not there is no Roger Ebert review. I'm sure someone from RogerEbert.com did write a review, but whenever I look for those reviews, I look specifically for Roger's stuff, and Roger had passed away in 2013, so there was no Roger Ebert review. There was no Gene Siskel review. But Joseph,
oh shit.
There wasn't a review, but I do have some words from your boy, your favorite, Armin White.
What did this moron say?
Okay, so in addition to being the house movie critic for the National Review, yes, the conservative magazine National Review, Armin White is also a writer for Out magazine. Armin White is a gay conservative movie critic, and he did for 2015 a list of the year's best gay movies, and the movie came in at number 11.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And his one little blurb said, Sean Baker's lo-fi in the life of two Los Angeles trans hustlers is raucously anti-Hollywood. Shot on cell phone technology, it makes sub-cult secrets personal and relatable, sisterhood and butt dialing redefined. So our first Armin White blurb, and he's not a piece of shit.
One of the few times I've ever said, yeah, I agree with you, Armin White.
Yeah, and just to bring it up, and just to bring it more relevant for Sammy, this is the same man that said, I love you, I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry is a better gay romance than Brokeback Mountain.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what we're dealing with. That's why I specifically look for his shit.
Look, I don't care what your opinion is about. I don't care where you stand politically. Brokeback Mountain is a phenomenally well done film. Like, yeah. I just don't feel like you can hate on how well that film was, like, executed. Yeah.
See, the thing with Armin White is no one gives a shit how he votes. What they give a shit about is he's a troll. He's a fucking troll. He gave Paddington 2 a negative review, keeping it from the perfect 100% score, but he also loves the movie Norbit.
And that movie's terrible.
I'm not sure he knows what film is.
Yeah. He loves to be a contrarian, and there Amy Nicholson from Unspooled and that show she used to do with the rapist, she has brought him onto her podcast before because she loves that he's a contrarian. He's also a huge Prince fan and wrote a book about Prince. So Armin White is the wild card of wild cards. He also got himself booted out of, like, the National Film Critics Circle for being an asshole. So, so
all right, but we have a Rotten Tomatoes score?
Well, I'm sure we do. And honestly, I did not see it this time because I specifically was avoiding it as I was pulling up shit. Like, I was even Googling Armin White and his Rotten Tomatoes page pulled up, and I was like, oh, wait, no, I don't even want to chance this. So okay, I'm clueless. Yes. So
I do have them. So what do y'all think it is?
Sammy, you want to go first?
I'm going to say this got a pretty good review, so I'm going to go like a 89%.
Okay.
Ooh. Lower than I'm going to go. I'm going to go with like a 95.
Ooh, John was very, very close. It's at a 96%.
Damn it. Oh, I was floating honestly between 95 and 96 and I lowballed it. Damn it.
There's like 150 reviews on it and it's certified fresh at 96%.
Yeah. I knew it was fresh. I just didn't know what the number was. So
what do y'all think the audience score is for this movie?
I think it's going to be a little lower.
I think so too, but I'm going to go with probably not much lower. Because while this doesn't necessarily have a wide audience appeal, I think the people that are going to go see it knew what they were getting into.
I think I'm going to do like a 92.
Okay. I was also going to say a 92, so I will go with a 91.
Okay, this one, it is lower. It's at a 76%.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's got like, geez, it's got like 11,000, almost 500 reviews.
Wow.
Yeah, it's got a lot of reviews. Got a lot of reviews.
Were any of the negative reviews like real, or were they troll reviews?
Like, the negative reviews is mostly because of how it was filmed. Like, some people didn't like that. And even the negative reviews from what I've seen, I'm not going through all of them, but it's like, it's just that they said, I just didn't like the structure of the movie, and it just didn't quite do it for them.
Yeah,
they started to get bored or something like that. That's what they said. But most people that liked it really liked it.
Okay. I have a question for you, Joseph, but I want to ask it off air.
Oh, okay.
Because we might be able to expand on this area as well.
Oh, okay.
I had thoughts.
You know, I think that the Bechdel test is going to be kind of obvious, but we'll go ahead and ask.
I didn't look it up, but I will look it up right now. As I'm pulling it up, I'm going to assume that it passed. Just because 2/3 of the main characters are women. And I am taking the official position for the entirety of the show that says trans women are women. That being said, it absolutely passed 3 out of 3 tests. Because eventually Cindy does stop talking about Chester to start talking about Dinah.
Oh, yeah, that's fair.
Before we move on to the next question, to the next segment, I have a question for the group. Do you think the meth they smoked in the bathroom was real?
No.
No, I don't think so either.
Okay. The only reason I agree with y'all is because the actress that plays Dinah has been in other roles. Had this been her only movie role, I would have been like, they are 100% smoking meth in the bathroom.
Yeah,
really? I could see
that. No. I'm saying, had that playing Dinah not had the other roles, I would have made the assumption that the meth was real.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I could see how you would think that.
Yeah, because if you looked her up and it just said...
That seems like a little bit of a bold choice, but...
I mean, I've seen a lot of movies that made bold, if not bolder choices than you, so that's why I asked. But we can now move into our next segment if you would like.
All right, so we've kind of mentioned a couple of them, but do y'all have any other best line, worst lines?
I do, and it's a terrible line, but I love it. It's from Cindy. She says, "Bitch, you know I don't do downers. Bitch, you know I'm an upper hoe." it's like Jesus. I also love that the first line in this movie is "Merry Christmas Eve, bitch," which is also the text message you are both going to get every December 24th until you block me on your phones. So.
I can see that happening.
Yeah. Mm.
Okay.
Traditions are important.
Now that John is blocked from my phone, I think mine was right after she first started looking for Chester, and Alexandra asked her, she goes, "Why are you looking for him? It's not his fault. Why aren't you looking for her?" or something like that. And then she goes, "You know what? You're right. I'm going to beat her up," or whatever. And she goes, "No, that's not what I meant."
Like, oh no, I made the bad idea worse.
Oh no. Joseph, did you have anything?
Yeah, because we already did the whole, which is called the whole precinct down there type, that line within the hotel room. But I did like whenever because Chester had a really funny moment when they're all smoking outside. He's like, so what's the deal? Does he got a big dick or what? She goes, what do you want to know about it? He's like, come on, spit it out. She goes, why don't I swallow? He goes, I walked into that one, didn't I?
Did y'all have any worse lines?
I don't think I did.
I don't have any worse lines. There are lines that came out of people in this mouths in this movie that I don't like, but that's the character, not the script. So
yeah, anything you're supposed to not like it, like especially when guys drive off and throw the urine when they say, or like, yeah, I didn't like what they did, but you're not supposed to.
There is one slightly cringy line, and that's the first time Razmik picks up a prostitute, and she's, you know, a cis female, and he asks, what the fuck is that? And she goes, it's a pussy. which is why I did wonder, like, is Razmik really into trans women, or is he a chaser? Because there's a difference. Do I need to explain chaser?
Yes.
A chaser is someone that only wants to have sex with trans women, but not be public about it. Like, their interest is only lies in the fact that, especially trans women who are pre-op.
I had no idea. That's a new thing for me.
I learned that phrase this year as well. So internet is sometimes an educational place and not an absolute cesspool. I mean, it's both, but...
But sometimes you can learn from it.
Yes. Sometimes you can learn from it, from the internet being an absolute cesspool.
Well, so I have a couple things for our second to last segment, the good, bad, and the ugly. But I'll go ahead and ask y'all first. Do y'all have anything?
I do love the camaraderie between Cindy and Alexandria. Like, no matter what horrible shit is happening, they both kind of have each other's backs. And I kind of also love that there's this weird camaraderie between them and Dinah as Alexandria is getting ready in the bathroom for her show, where it's just like suddenly all three of them are on the same level.
Yeah, I did like that too. Because honestly, I don't think she really hated Dinah. She was just acting out because she didn't know what else to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's not Dinah's fault. I mean, it's a little her fault, but it's not most. It's all Chester's fault.
Because I don't think Dinah didn't know that he had a girlfriend or really even cared.
No, and Dinah also made that point earlier. You know, she's never had a pimp that didn't fuck her. So,
way of life for her.
Yeah, you know, for her, it's just fucking Wednesday.
Yeah, I like the whole camaraderie between them as well. And even the cab driver, he had a huge amount of respect for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I did like that.
Yeah. Like, even if he does have some chaser tendencies, he did have respect for them. Like, I think the only thing keeping him from dating them out in the open is him being married.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I love the scene in the motel where Cindy goes and basically drags Dinah out. Oh, and of course, I love the fact that Clue Gulager from Nightmare on Elm Street 2 just shows up to have a random conversation in the back about how he was named May, which the story he's telling about how he was named after the May-May bird, his real name is he was named after the Clue bird.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, so he wrote a little reality to it.
I did like that right after the guy puked in his car and everything, the next one he picks up, like, dude, your car reeks. He's like, I know, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He rolled down the window, stuck her head out. I was like, that's not helping.
Yeah. I can't remember who someone bought him a Christmas gift. It was an air freshener. He's like, you know.
So one of the things I liked about it, apart from the filming, I just think that he did a really good job of carrying on like three different storylines. And that can be pretty difficult, especially in a movie this short. I think he did a fairly good job of doing that. Each storyline got enough attention. So I think that was pretty well executed.
Yeah. And two of the three main characters had a happy ending, ish. I mean, yes, one of them got piss thrown on her. So that's not a happy ending, but at the end of the movie, she and Alexandria have that moment together. Whereas Razmik has a whole bunch of uncomfortable conversations about to be having had up in his house. So, do we have any bad and ugly? Because I know I got one.
Yeah, go.
I don't think I have any, actually.
Well, I think I speak for the group that the puke scene was a little too visceral.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I give you that.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I used to eat like dinner watching Nip Tuck reruns. I can eat during Train Spotting. That one brief, I still maintain the word brief. That one moment was enough to make me go, you know what? I don't need to finish this. And it was a really good vegan pizza. And I'd eat most of it. But as for anything like story wise, I think everything in this movie is just real or is either real or real and just real enough that if something's bad, it's by design. Made me definitely not want to be a cab driver.
Oh, yeah. I already just made it worse.
I completely disagree. I totally think that scene was unnecessary. You know, that's.
Well, I'm going to offer a controversial opinion. That scene is a little bit more necessary than, like, Clue Gulager's entire monologue about his name.
Fair.
There was that. I just think that my problem with the overall film was just that, okay, sometimes films about nothing work, right? You know, where they don't have a very complex storyline, they're really not about much. Sometimes it works. In this case, for me, it didn't really work. It was literally just about this woman on a rampage to find her cheating ex-boyfriend. That was the crux of it. And then a cab driver who was struggling with his home life and his fascination with, you know, trans women prostitutes.
Yeah. Well,
but that was it. Like, fair, I mean, I don't know. There just wasn't a lot for me to care about.
Yeah, but you can take, you know, the cheating boyfriend story, throw Reese Witherspoon in it and stretch that shit out for 90 to 100 minutes. And of course, you know, the stories of the weird obsessions of cab drivers, Martin Scorsese already knocked that shit out of the park in the mid 70s. Mm-hmm. So
I'm going to be honest, and I'm not just saying this. I don't know that if they made a 90-minute Reese Witherspoon movie about her on a vendetta for her cheating ex, depending on how they did it, that I would give a shit either.
Yeah, but we would probably end up doing it for the show. So,
yeah, this is true.
And I think on this point, I'd add a question. Joseph, Sammy, did y'all survive Tangerine?
I want to hear what Sammy has to say first.
Yeah,
why me?
because Joseph and I have telegraphed ours from the minute we started talking.
Oh yeah.
This is a really hard one. This is a really hard one for me because I have a lot of respect for how they made this film. Making a film using iPhones could not have been easy. The script was decent. They made a very passable film. You know, as much as I said it wasn't about anything, it did have a at least semi-cohesive storyline. He took three separate storylines, made them intertwine in at least a way that made sense. Like, you know, all those people were connected somehow. And so that was very interesting. He kind of made it documentary style without it being a documentary. There's a lot to like about this film. The problem I have is, did I care? No. And that's a personal problem. Also, will I ever watch this film again? No. It's depressing. And which sometimes I like, but this is not the type of depressing I could get behind. It just made me sad. Like, I don't know.
Well, before you give your answer, just remember, surviving, liking, and recommending are kind of two sides of the same coin. Like, I can survive. Joseph and I love this movie called The Piano Teacher. It is a very dark, very hard to watch, almost thriller kind of psychosexual drama. I would not recommend that as entertainment, but I would say I survived it as for the filmmaking aspect. Whereas, I don't know if I could recommend Bob Saget's Dirty Work as a piece of filmmaking, because all of the arguments against it are from critics are absolutely valid. But do I find that film incredibly entertaining and could watch it on an endless loop? Yes. So that's how I kind of I've always approached whether or not I survive. So if you want to take and make your own variation of that, go for it.
Yeah,
because I get where you're coming from 100%.
I do ask the question, would I ever watch it again? Okay, that plays into it, but that only plays into it too much. Then there's like the Baby Jane effect, right? So remember when we watched Baby Jane, and I could recognize good filmmaking. I knew what it was coming from. There's nothing wrong with how the filmmaker made the film. I could tell that it was like well crafted, well acted, like all of that kind of stuff, but it was just not for me. You know, that's the other side of the line where I recognize, okay, I'm probably going to go ahead and say I survived this because it's a film that I know is well done, but it's just not for me. Yeah. Then there's a film on the other side of it. And so, you know, even when I say, no, will I probably ever watch that again? No, I won't. But yes, I would recommend it. Whereas this film is kind of on, this film sort of, I think where I ended up landing is I barely didn't survive. Mostly because while I can recognize what the filmmaker was trying to do and appreciate the fact that it was good filmmaking, not only is it not for me, I don't even know if I would recommend it. Because it's just such a niche thing. It's like, hey, it's okay, I'm not comparing it, by the way, do not, like, nobody take this as an insult. I'm not comparing it to The Room in skill or filmmaking or any of that. Obviously, there's no comparison in how much better of a film that this is than The Room, filmmaking wise, and he did it with a freaking iPhone, Tommy Wiseau.
He only used one camera, whereas Tommy used two.
But
I always remember that.
The difference being, the only reason I could see to recommend this film is for some type of cultural significance. The way you might recommend The Room for cultural significance, right? It's something that you recommend because it like marks a moment in time. It's everybody saw it. Like, I could see doing that, you know, recommending this to a film student because it's an important cultural thing that they should watch and they should learn from. But to the average Joe, I'm never going to recommend this film because it's hard to watch.
Can I offer you a counterpoint to this before either Joseph or I answer? There is another movie that you could very easily compare this movie to because you're almost rating it the same way I did. And that's Tammy and the T-Rex. Do I recognize that movie is an abominable piece of shit and wrong in almost every way? Yes. Do I find it entertaining to watch with a group? Yes. Would I ever watch that movie again on my own? Absolutely not. So Tangerine is your much better made Tammy and the T-Rex.
Sure.
Like the way you're describing it is the way I feel about Tammy and the T-Rex. It's just, this is good filmmaking and Tammy and the T-Rex was not.
You know what this reminded me of? I just remembered the film. I was thinking, man, this reminds me of something. Way better comparison. Was it Wanda?
Wanda, yeah.
Wanda. This reminds me of how I felt about Wanda. I knew the film was well made. I knew there was something there. You could recommend it for cultural significance. I just didn't care. You didn't hook me. I wasn't invested. It was boring. So I'm not going to recommend it to somebody else because I just, you know.
Right. And honestly, before we even did this episode, whenever I told you I wasn't sure if you were going to survive it or not, Wanda was the clip that was playing in my head when I said that. And you just brought that back to life. So that's a perfect one.
That's what it reminds me of. Except I would say, I don't remember one enough well enough to know which one I would watch again.
I feel, honestly, I think I can answer that for you. I think if you had them both put out in front of you, you would probably pick Tangerine because there's at least some shit happening.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I think you're right. And it's shorter.
Yeah. Actually, I think it's about the same length. it feels shorter. All right, Joseph, I'm pretty sure I don't have to walk you through your answer, but give it to us anyway.
No, I don't think so, because I'm pretty sure I know where I land on mine. I survived it. I thought it was really well done. I had no idea what to expect from it. I just know the bare minimum of what this movie was kind of about. And I really liked it. I liked how it was just kind of like a done kind of documentary style, or just, except there's no narration or anything like that. It was just one of those, like, you just went through the lives of these people a day in a life, and it just goes horribly wrong near the end.
Would you guys like a fancy film snob way of saying documentary style?
What's that?
Sure.
Cinema verite.
Okay.
Because that's what that is. So if you want to be snobby about it, that's what y'all can pull out.
No, I don't want to be.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Obviously, we've already picked our pick for next week, but I know what the next film I want to do is, because I want to show y'all a depressing style, very slow film that I absolutely love.
Small Rats, isn't it?
Yes. Damn it, John, you're in it.
Well, I guess I should answer whether or not I survived.
Yes.
All right. So I didn't have to think very hard. Of the three of us, I am the only one that I can safely say watch this movie three times, because, you know, I started a week ago and my memory's shit. I like this film. I did survive it. I very strongly like this film. And I kind of agree with, oh God, here's a sentence I never thought I'd say. I agree with Armin White. It's one of the best. It was probably one of the best gay films of 2015. It's one of the best LGBT films I have seen in a while. And having watched The Florida Project and this, I now have a pretty firm grasp on the films of Sean Baker. So I have an expectation of what I'm going to get. Am I going to watch this movie again? The answer is probably yes, but it's going to be a while, because like a lot of films that I watch more than once, I need a break from them, and I definitely need a break from them, because if we push this record date again, there was no way I was emotionally prepared to sit through this again, because it is a very heavy film, and I get, it takes like Sammy's like, do I ever want to see this again? Fuck no. I get that. This film is not for everyone, but I would recommend it. Not necessarily to average Joe, but people that I do know that either have an interest in like indie cinema or LGBT audiences, definitely. Kind of that crowd. If you tell me your favorite film is Transformers 2, I'm probably going to stop speaking to you, but then also not recommend this movie to you. So, I think we did this last year, and I kind of want to do it again. And if we didn't, I want to do that before we get into what we're doing next week. But we love ranking shit around here. We just did 4 movies for Pride Month, even though like 7 episodes came out this month. You're welcome, listener. So what is your rank for this year's Pride Month selections? Them Ooh. Being Tangerine, But I'm a Cheerleader, Shiva Baby, and Nightmare on Elm Street 2.
Okay, I'm going to kind of maybe... this is a tough one. Okay, I know that But I'm a Cheerleader, I think, is number one. Okay. Pretty safe. really fighting with Shiva Baby and Nightmare on Elm Street because they're so different. Like, that would really depend on the movie.
What are you talking about? They're both horror movies and comedies at the same time.
So really, honestly, it would depend on what kind of mood I... I guess Shiva Baby has an edge because it's the type of movie I'd be more likely to watch.
Mm-hmm.
But Nightmare on Elm Street was a lot of fun. And then, obviously, this one is number four.
Joseph?
Well, I'm going to go with Semi on the first one because I really... But I'm a trailer. I remember watching that back when it first came out, and I liked it. And I think it's still great. It's still really good. I think that's my favorite one out of all of them so far. And coming at a close second, I like Shiva Baby quite a bit. I was not sure what to expect from that one either, and I absolutely liked it. I loved it. I thought it was one of those that just had a really unique way of filming. I just really enjoyed that one. And I think Tangerine would be three. It's just because I think it's a better movie than Nightmare on Elm Street 2, and I do love that movie. But also, I think this is a much more important movie. but also, you know, because in none of these I don't like. I like all four of them. It's just in varying degrees. But Nightmare on Elm Street is, I think, the lesser of the four, just because... It is a cheesy
it's Nightmare on Elm Street 2.
It's Nightmare on Elm Street 2. And again, I like Nightmare on Elm Street 2. It is a lot of cheesy fun in it, how like the quote unquote subtext in the movie.
Yeah.
But I think the other three are better than that. But like I said, I don't regret any of them, and I would gladly own all four of these movies.
So we are 3-for-3 for But I'm a Cheerleader. Being number one, that is because it's a combination of this movie is fun, it touches on important issues, and is well made. And Joseph, you and I are in agreement on Nightmare on Elm Street 2 being in number four, as much as we love it. Subtext, text, no text, that movie has a lot of problems.
It does. Damn it.
There are moments that it's not a well-made movie, and but it is one that, and it coming in last. Just sorry, remember, John, that is a movie.
Sleepaway Camp ranks your top 100. I said I'm sorry. Remind me where Sleepaway ranks.
I still maintain Sleepaway Camp is a better made movie than Nightmare on Elm Street 2. And you derailed me because now I'm like, is Sleepaway Camp in my top 100? I should have that list memorized. And now I am having to pull this up. And internet's being a bitch. You should have like had that question for me at the beginning of the night.
I'm sorry. I was just trying to derail your argument as to why Nightmare on Elm Street should be last.
Well, it has problems in the filmmaking aspect. But do I love that movie and could easily watch it? Yeah, I probably would watch Sleepaway Camp over it. Mostly because, number one, if I'm going to put an Elm Street film on heavy rotation, it's going to be the third one. And there is a Sleepaway Camp version on Shudder that has Joe Bob Briggs commentary. So I'm probably, if I'm watching Sleepaway Camp, I'm going to watch that. So that's where I'm going to land. As for the middle... Honestly, I have Shiva Baby and Tangerine tied. Like, they're interchangeable because I like them both, and they're both well-made films, but for different reasons. Shiva Baby is probably the more lighthearted of the two, if that's possible. But, yeah, so I think just for consistency, I would probably put Shiva Baby number two and Tangerine at number three, even though I still think that they're pretty interchangeable.
Oh, okay.
Okay. But, yeah, so we wrap a bow on one more Pride Month, but I believe Sammy gets to step on the plate and enact swift, bloody revenge. What are you doing to us next week?
And we're kind of going off script here a little bit, and we're doing...
Actually, Sammy, before you announce it, Sleepaway Camp is not in my top 100 films of all time.
Okay, I was waiting on that.
It finally loaded. I'm going to edit the list. I'm going to put it just before A Few Good Men, just to annoy you.
That's just not okay.
Actually, I'm going to put Bound, Evil Dead 2, and Sleepaway Camp right before A Few Good Men.
Okay, this is just okay. This is just wrong. Yeah. What we're going to be doing next week is the aptly named The Hating Game, and
which is what we also call recording every episode of this.
Right, exactly.
So, and this is going to be a film, one that Joseph and I hadn't even heard of before tonight. So, which, perfect. You know, y'all hadn't heard of Shiva Baby either. So, I guess this is fair.
For a hot second, I was just like, did they make a movie called The Dating Game? But it was like, oh, Hating Game. Okay, gotcha.
Is there a difference?
Guys, it's about the line between hate and love.
We stand by what we said. It's Chuck Woolery in this. Wow, that reference may be so old, even Joseph doesn't get it. All right, so yeah, The Hating Game next week. It's on Hulu if you want to watch along with us, and you know, check out the episode, you know, somewhere around the 1st of August by the time I get around to editing it. So maybe I should hold on to this episode for Christmas. I can feel Sammy over there scowling. Anyway, does anybody have anything they want to plug this week? But is there a character in the entirety of this show as awesome as Catherine Jean Covey? Or whatever the little sister's character name was.
It's just different. It's different. It's a different kind of show.
So that was a lot of words for no.
Yeah, but there's characters that are equally as loved.
I mean, I guess I did like the fact that I survived the second two of the trilogy.
Yeah, so you survived two out of three. Episode.
In retrospect, I should probably have retroactively flipped my vote for the first film, but, you know.
And honestly, I would say this was more well done because it kind of answered the question, I think, of would this be better as a movie or a TV series? I think I've never read the books. It makes me want to read the books, but I think that it fit better as a TV series. It just allowed a lot more character development, and I'm really excited to see where the other seasons go.
Joseph?
No, I have nothing. I'm sorry. I don't have anything to plug this week at all.
I probably could, you know, pull something out of my ass this week, but I just don't have anything that, like, stands out. I am slowly going through the to be listened to pile of albums for work, slowly working on my best of list for the year. I will, I'll give a quick plug to an album that came out a few months ago. And it does fit in for Pride Month. It's an album called Heterosexuality by an artist called Shamir. It's Shamir's eighth album. So, I have seven other records apparently to listen to, but Shamir is a soul, kind of a soul R&B. The way I would describe him, and I'm using the correct pronouns, even though he is non-binary, I've described him as the non-binary offspring of Prince, because he kind of has that falsetto voice that Prince can hit pretty well, and his a lot of the album is about struggling with sexual and gender identity. Plus, it's just a really good record. The guys from the podcast I let build up and ignore, Sound Opinions, recommended me this album, and I'm glad I checked it out. And so if you like stuff kind of like Prince, but not as weird as Prince can get, check this one out.
Awesome.
Before y'all think I insulted Prince, y'all go listen to the entirety, all five discs of Crystal Ball, and come back to me. So, all right, well, Sammy, you get to enact your revenge next week with the hating game. Looking forward to that. And thank you all, thank you and Joseph for doing another episode. Listeners, thank you for putting up with us for another week. And until next week, y'all, there's a little bit of Pride Month left, so just be safe out there.
Surviving Chick Flicks is brought to you by the Circle of Jug. The show is edited by John, and all clips used are the property of their copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. Please follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, and leave us a 5-star rating at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get the show. If there's anything you would like us to cover on the show, or just drop us a line at survivingchickflicks@gmail.com. The show is copyright 2022, Circle of Jug Productions, all rights reserved.
Stop. But all I'm going to say is this. Get that motherfucker.